if you do have any sort of trauma, it is possible to have a healthy, normal pregnancy. And mm-hmm. anyone is like afraid of that. Like the best thing I did for myself was have like a month of therapy before the delivery of my second. And Ooh. The therapist like really just focused, because I had what was a form of PTSD from it. And worrying,
of course,
it's going to happen again. And I would leave my daughter without a mother and, you know, all of that. So I think that really gets your head in the game and you focus on how you're a survivor and not a victim. Mm.
Welcome to the New Mamas Podcast. This podcast was created to help first-time moms everywhere navigate this new stage of life and to talk about the honest and the raw moments in motherhood. I'm your host, Lena Forrestal. I'm a working mom by day and a blogger and photographer by mid-afternoon. And as a first-time mom myself, I'm on this journey with you. So, new mamas, let's do it. Let's kick off the episode and get to the good stuff. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Ashley Hutchings about her story about how she gave birth in London and New York City, and how her family made the life change from living in a New York high-rise to a historic home in Connecticut. This episode is going to be a little different in that we're going to be having a more casual chat about Ashley's motherhood journey. Listeners, I hope you love it. Ashley, thank you for joining me. Before we kick things off, did you want to share a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you for having me. You know, I'm now also 6 months pregnant. So in addition to my London journey and New York City journey, this will be the first time giving birth in a rural setting up in Connecticut. So I'm going to have perspectives from all over. And, you know, we take COVID lockdown life very seriously. So currently, we're just kind of backyard hangs, making snowmen, hide and seek. And I'm really only leaving the house for prenatal appointments. So I'm looking forward to warmer weather.
Yeah, I can definitely relate with that. So actually, Ashley, I have kind of a similar story as you. So my husband and I lived in Bangkok, Thailand, in like a super high rise apartment. And then we moved back to the States. And we now live in a farm in Western New Jersey, like rural, same thing.
I saw that on your bio, I think it was. That is so different. Did you have your son here or there?
I had my son here, and that was really more because of the wishes of our family. But I think if, you know, our family wasn't involved, I think I would have absolutely had birth in Thailand. I would think it would have been really interesting. And I feel like this is kind of not trendy, but I feel like a lot of people, even before the pandemic, were looking at having more space for their families and to grow. I don't know. We'll like dive into your story and like why you made that decision. But let's start with your love story.
Oh, my goodness. So it's actually pretty funny because everyone thinks my husband's British. I mean, he's technically a British citizen now because he lived in London for so long, but he's born here in America. But so many people think it was some man with this like British. But we actually went to the same high school here in Connecticut, but didn't know each other because he's like 8.5 years older. So we didn't know each other. We were introduced by friends in our 20s, but you know, we were dating other people, whatever. So many years go by and his brother was remodeling my bathroom and he was visiting from London. So he stops over to say hi to his brother and we just get to chatting. So he's only on holiday from London at this point because he's working over there in finance. So we get to chatting and, you know, we're drinking beers, hanging out. So there was a spark. Then a couple of days later, he's like, oh, I'm going to say goodbye to my brother one more time, which he just said to be able to come over and talk to me again. But his brother never showed up. So we end up hanging out till 4 a.m, like, you know, it was a summer night, drinking beers on my stoop all night. He invites me to New York City the next weekend before he goes to London. And we have like this whirlwind weekend at the Standard and on the High Line walking around. And it was so
Oh my God.
So then we're like, we totally are so into each other. So then we embark on a long distance relationship in London to New York City, flying from New York City, but I was in Connecticut for a year and a half. So every 3 weeks we took turns going back from London to New York, and that we did that for a year and a half. And then he proposed on Halloween. We got married. We eloped 2 months later at City Hall in New York City. He proposed in Paris, and then we eloped in New York City. I got my visa. And then by March I moved over there. So I was there for 4 years. He was there probably 10.
Wow. Yeah. That is a whirlwind love story. And I love that it seemed to pretty much like happen pretty fast, right?
Yeah. Well, when you're so in love, you know, like you just want to be next to each other. So like,
yes.
At the year mark was when like we really knew, and there was no sense waiting for us, you know?
Cliche, but when you know, you know. Same thing. My husband and I got engaged. Like, we met on Tinder. I moved into his place 3 months later. We got matching tattoos. And then on our year anniversary, he proposed. It was, and my friends all thought I was nuts. But it really was like true love.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, do you watch that like Millionaire Matchmaker with Patty Stanger?
No, I should. I want to. I don't
know if it's on anymore, but she had like a rule that if you don't know by a year, that's it. You're done. Like there's, that's like the mark of whether it's going to be a make or break relationship point. Like if you don't know you want to marry this person at the year mark. For older,
you know,
if you're in your 20s, yes, or whatever.
Yeah, if you're like in your early 20s, right, you don't even know who you are.
Yeah.
But I feel like when I was 25, 26, I knew exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I feel like exactly when you meet that person, you're like, I just know, like, this is my human. And it's returned, right? Because I feel like also in our early 20s, some, or even in our teens, we do a lot of this, like, chase, where we, like, chase people that aren't necessarily into us, or, you know what I mean?
I think it takes time to know what your own values are and who you are. Mm-hmm. So, like, the older you are, you're maybe meeting people and judging if they're in line with your values instead of developing yours. So for
us, yes,
you know, my husband was like late 30s when we got married. So it was like he had to know himself by now, or then he was like never going to at that point.
Yeah. And he, exactly. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So then you moved to London.
I moved to London, and, you know, I was there like 4 years working and just enjoying married life, getting to know each other in that sense. Cause like long distance relationship is so romantic and these just drawn out gorgeous weekends, but then you're living with someone and just in it. And it's not like you have a place to retreat to. Like you are just all of a sudden in another country with a new last name. Like here I am. But it was beautiful. We traveled a lot. We did so much stuff. And then I got pregnant with our daughter, and she was born in 2016. She was born in 2017. And then I gave birth on the NHS, which is the public healthcare system in England, which was.
Yes. Tell us. Tell us everything.
So, okay. Basically, I think the first and foremost, I think healthcare, everyone should have this access to healthcare. Like the NHS is beautiful. It's amazing, but it's not without its problems. So you are not looking at any high-end healthcare by any means when it comes to like emergency or taking care of you. Like they are there, but you are not getting all the bells and whistles, I guess is the best way to put it. So when you go there for your prenatal appointments, you'll never meet a doctor. You only meet with midwives, and you never get to see the same person twice. So that was probably my biggest gripe, because like the continuity of care just isn't there.
And you feel absolutely like
you're re-explaining yourself to every single person you meet with. Now, things may have changed because that was 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. But at that point, they didn't have any electronic documents either. So you're bringing like a binder with you to each appointment, and you have to, you have to carry it with you at all times in case you go to like premature labor. So like always in your purse, they want you to have your binder health record, which was really interesting. So that was one of like the really big differences is, and you get less appointments. So less ultrasounds, less appointments, you know, they don't give you a pregnancy test. They just kind of take your word for it. And you go to just your GP for the first 2 months, because you don't have gynecologists there either.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So just to digress a little bit. So the NHS doesn't give a woman a pap smear. They just call it a smear there until they're 25 years old. So whereas we might grow up going at 16 or whenever you're sexually active, they don't have that. So
that is so for me, like if I didn't have a pat, I had HPV. Yeah. And that developed into like pre-cancer, and I needed to have surgery on my cervix at when I was like 23. I can't imagine if I didn't have a pap smear, like what that would look like.
So the way the NHS works, it's more like there are so many examples of that, but because it's a public health care system, they have to do it on like the odds and risks. So
right,
there will always be people that fall through the cracks with that, but they kind of take an overall picture, and that's why they make a lot of the decisions they do, is what I've done. Mm-hmm. And I did work in the healthcare system over there. That was my profession. I was in medical sales. So I did get to know the ins and outs of the private and public sector really well.
Interesting.
Yes. So, and then when you do age to 25 and you want to get a pap smear, you go just to the GP, the same doctor you go to for everything, and they'll either perform it, or if you're uncomfortable, they have women's health like clinic hours and someone might perform it. But it was the most, I'm trying to think of a good term. It was a very, very basic service. Like they're using a plastic speculum. They're having you hold your legs. Like it is just, you're in kind of like a back room of like a school. It's very, very different, very different. So fast forward, I have those prenatal appointments. So that's like one of the big differences. You have less and you don't see the same person every time. They do have a better system called NCT. Now, NCT is a prenatal course. They kind of put you in touch with people in your neighborhood by your zip code. So it's a private service, but it's only like $100 for the entire semester. Whereas like in New York City, if you wanted prenatal classes, they could be $1,000. And you might be paired with people from all over Manhattan, right? Or you might have to gather your own. So did you have some sort of prenatal moms group that you had for education?
No. And I think, I don't know if part of that was because of the pandemic. Well, no, because the pandemic only started in March. But no, I didn't have anything like that.
Yeah. So they, I think it's just more of a community. So I still text with like the NCT moms that I met just based on my zip code. And it was like 10 weeks of classes teaching you everything about pain management and labor and just like kind of a Lamaze class idea. So I thought they did a better job with that. So then in terms of the actual birth, I think overall I appreciated the London way of birthing. I think it was felt less like a hospital. It was darker. It was calmer. You're meeting with just one midwife. People aren't coming in and out. They don't push the drugs on you the same as I feel like they do here. That part I thought was great. I did have complications after my first, which got a little crazy. And then doctors did have to come in, but it wasn't until after my daughter was born and I started having complications that I met my first doctor, the whole experience.
Wow. Interesting.
Oh, if that makes sense, that timeline makes sense at all.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So there definitely is a difference. And it's interesting because in Thailand, they have a government health system, but then they have a privatized system. So most of the foreigners and expats there usually go to the private hospitals. And they very are. And I think medical tourism is really big in Asia. So, and especially in Thailand. So we went to like a really nice hospital and it was like a 5-star, like it was very luxurious. Like I got bit by a monkey when we were over there. And I needed to get a rabies shot, like because I didn't have the rabies vaccine. And it was just a very interesting experience because it was horrible, but they brought me in and like, they give you water and they like massage your like shoulder. It's just like a very different.
Well, Thailand has a giant, giant market for plastic surgery, which brings in
yes.
a ton of money. And a lot of, because mm-hmm. I worked in medical here, a lot of surgeries like gender reassignments, a lot of hospitals won't even do in the US, but
wow.
because of lawsuits, like a lot of different doctors just won't do them because mm-hmm. one of gender reassignment has one of the highest percentages of suing your doctor afterwards. So a lot of those people choose to go to Thailand where there's less lawsuits, less regulation, which is interesting.
I didn't know that. Yeah. But yeah, you could literally get like a lunchtime nose job. Like there's so much It's very, very interesting. And what they do is, like, they cut a slit on the top of your nose, and then they insert, like, a piece of plastic into it, and it gives you, like, a more, like, triangular formed nose. It's just so interesting.
That sounds so painful and awful.
I know.
What the NHS or the UK does have, they do have private hospitals and private healthcare, and a lot of the expats do opt to go private. But when you are an expat sent to, say, London to work, but you're still employed via the US, then you have kind of an expat package, which means you have better insurance. Maybe you have a higher monthly allowance. My husband and I were treated, he was a citizen, he was treated as a full London.
I see.
British person being paid in England. So we were either going to pay like $15,000 to have give birth in a private hospital, or give birth for free on the NHS. Like,
no. How can you even compare that?
The same physicians, like the NHS doctors have private hours. Really, the only thing you're paying for is basically just the luxuries, like having the continuity of care, like having meals included. Okay, so that's another thing too. They don't give you anything. So you have to pack every single thing, like literally everything. Like you pack your own diapers, your own wipes, you bring your own towel, you bring your own pillow, you bring your own pads. Like you will not get one single thing on the NHS, which I'm kind of a control freak. So I appreciated that. Like I wanted my little organic diapers. I didn't want whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I was fine with that, but that's shocking to some people.
Yeah. I'm a little bit with you where I'm very particular. I like my own things. So when we went to the hospital here, well, also it was during COVID. So they did recommend to bring your own. You can't leave the hospital room once we were in it. So we brought everything. We brought a whole thing of snacks. We brought refrigerated food. Like there was a lot of things that we brought on our own. So I don't necessarily feel like I would hate that.
Yeah, you could have been fine. I feel like that's almost like...
Yeah, right. I would have fit right in. But maybe there's more education there. Like you said, the prenatal groups. I feel like there's a lot more accessible prenatal education than there is here. I knew nothing. I had no idea. Like down to like having a little outfit for him. I had no idea what size diapers to get. I got ones that were too big. I didn't know anything. And I guess maybe that's my fault, but I was so overwhelmed. There's information overwhelm that I didn't even know where to start.
I think that's why those prenatal courses were so great, and they do make them so accessible. And I think that's what I paid pounds for the course, but I do think depending on your income, like they do offer them for free. So they make it
very That's nice.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So the prenatal care I just think is so much better over there. But also the NHS wants to save money. So they don't want you having to go to the hospital. The US is the opposite. The more you go to the hospital, the more they can bill you, you know? So I always say to people, if you're sick for anything, go on nhs.co.uk website and Google your illness, and you'll get more information through that than any US site. They don't want you to go to the hospital is basically.
Yeah. Wow. That's mind blowing.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. There was one other issue with that though, the recovery rooms. So you can pay for a private room following an NHS birth. They're like £1,000 or something like that. And my husband and I paid for it. We reserved it, but because I had complications, I had to forego the private room and was then in observation following the birth for one night. And then I was moved to the recovery, the basic labor ward for people that didn't pay. And that was miserable because they're not like in New York City or wherever where you just have two people to a room, an actual ward with just curtains. So picture kind of an emergency room sort of setting. So a room with just curtains and one bathroom. So you're sharing one bathroom with a huge part of the ward. So when I say there's not bells and whistles, like there's really not.
Yeah, like that would have been really hard for me.
Yes, yes. So that was difficult. But then I had, you know, I had my New York City birth, and they offered the same thing. You could pay for a private room there. I lived down the street from Mount Sinai Hospital, and I had a 2-year-old at that point, so I didn't want to pay for the private room. I wanted my husband to go back and stay with her. I wanted to get in and out of the hospital as quickly as possible. So we didn't pay for it in that sense, but we only shared with one other person. So that was different.
Yes. And not an entire ward. Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Yes. Were there any other notable differences in your births from giving birth in London to giving birth in New York City?
So my first birth was very long. I mean, both my births were very long, but my first one was just like miserable. I was 9 days late with her. I ended up having contractions for 50 hours, like before they finally induced me. And I think it went so long because of the lack of continuity of care in England. Like I wasn't talking to the same person when I was complaining about how bad the contractions were. I was always re-explaining right. things. So I kind of blame them a little bit for letting it progress that long. So then at that point, after 50 hours, I was induced. And that's when I had all the drugs. Like I tried gas and air, which is referred to as laughing gas here, the shot in the leg, which I don't know if they give in the US, and then finally had an epidural. And then 10 hours later, she was born. At that point, I had a retained placenta. So that's why I had to go to theaters, which is what they call the OR. And they had to take out the placenta. But at that point, I hemorrhaged. So I lost like 40% of the blood in my body. Like it was significant. So
that oh my goodness.
Took a couple hours to like patch up, I guess, for lack of a better term. So, you know, there was a lot that happened. My birth plan was to be, you know, unmedicated in the birth center, and it just completely went awry. And I don't know what caused any of that, but I felt like a lot of it could have been avoided if I just had closer eyes on me, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then in the U.S., with my second daughter, I had the labor was still, I think, 44 hours long, but I was able to labor at home a lot longer because I was so close to the hospital. And I felt like the doctor and I were really in sync because I saw the same guy every single time. So once I went to his office, he snuck me in because he's like, this is really going a long time. I want to check you out. And I was already like 7 centimeters at that point walking around. So he's like, go home, take a tablespoon of castor oil and come back in a couple hours. So I did that.
Wait, he sent you home at 7 centimeters?
Yeah. Well,
dilated?
Yes, but he was not in the office. He was not at the hospital, like his office.
Oh.
I was already not at the office or at the hospital in my house. Like his office was here. My house is here.
Oh.
You know, like I could see it out my window. So he's like, go home, get your bag, put your daughter down for her nap, take a tablespoon of castor oil, which is often not recommended. But my daughter also, well, this pregnancy was a high risk doctor because I had the hemorrhaging and the placenta issues the first time. So I felt like he knew what he was doing, you know, who knows?
For sure.
He's not there anymore. So I don't know if that says anything. I take a spoonful of castor oil. I get back to the hospital. I get to the hospital. It's at 2:30 in the afternoon, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm out there for like a half hour with my husband, just in the waiting room, and someone comes over and they're like, you know, what were you dilated this morning? And I said 7 centimeters. And they're like, oh gosh, it's your first baby, right? And I'm like, no, my second. And they're like, oh my gosh. So they take it to the room and she was born within 2 hours. So at 4, yeah. But with that, I was really wanted unmedicated. Like that, it was so important to me. And I must've been asked for an epidural like 12 times. And I was so discouraged at how much they were in my face about it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, how did that conversation go? Like, was it like, do you want the epidural or are you sure you don't want the epidural? Like, how did that?
And like so many more nurses I felt like came in the US birth. So every single different person asked me. So someone else came in like, oh, are you
having
an epidural? And I'm just like, get out of my face. So
yeah,
luckily I was able to kind of be an advocate for myself. And my husband was too, but in those moments, you know, he just sees me in so much pain. I feel like he's kind of the husband that gets a little quieter and just kind of like does what he's told instead.
Yes, same with mine.
Yeah, I don't think you know how they're going to react till you're in that.
Yeah. My husband, like, bless him, I don't think he said like 2 words through like the whole thing.
Would you have guessed that from him?
No. I thought he would have been like more involved, but I think he was just like really taken out of his element. So he was just like, yeah, whatever. He was like, what do you want me to do? I was like, sit. Okay. Like, yeah.
Yes.
So funny.
So, you know, I was able to have my unmedicated wishes and I really fought for that. And then afterwards went to the shared room and had a terrible roommate, but whatever, What are you going to do?
Oh, no.
I felt great, though. You know, after having complications with my first, I felt like $1 million. I didn't have any medication, so I was very alert. And they hold you in the U.S. for 24 hours. Like, once the clock turned 24 hours, we were out of there and walked home. And it was great.
Nice. So your first birth, you did have medicated.
Yeah. So after, it was like 50 hours of contractions. And when they induced me at the same time I had them do the epidural, prior to that, I did try the gas and air and the shot. And that just made me vomit.
I don't know what the shot in the leg is.
It's like an opiate, I think. Like, it's called, I can't remember what it's called. And it might have, I don't even know they do that here. But it's like the three stages. Like, first you try the laughing gas, then you try that, and to see if you could ramp up without having an epidural.
I see. So what was it like giving birth medicated and then unmedicated?
Oh my gosh.
Because it's something, I had a medicated birth, but I'm just curious, is there a huge difference?
Once I had the epidural, I felt nothing contraction-wise. Like, I was literally looking at the monitor to see if I was having a contraction.
Oh, wow.
Until the end. And then I stopped pushing the button because they're like, you'll have more control over it if you stop pushing the button. Because I don't know if in the U.S. you have that capability to self-administer the epidural.
I think some hospitals do and then some don't. Like, for me, it was just a shot in the back. And
that was it.
They
controlled.
But I still felt things, though. I don't know if maybe they do, like, a lower dosage.
Right. Which also, I think, might be referred to as a walking epidural when you have more control over your lower parts. So for me, I just stopped pushing the button at the end so I could feel more and really get the baby out when it came time to push, which was painful. But, like, also I was shattered because it was 60 hours. So I don't know what I should have been feeling in relation to a shorter birth. I don't know. But so following my epidural, I was really uncomfortable. I had a lot of back pain. I couldn't do upward dog and yoga for months. Like,
wow.
I don't know if you had any of those sensations.
No, I was, but I think I'm an anomaly because I've heard a lot of people they still feel, like, a lot of women have told me, I still feel where the epidural went in, but I was really blessed. Like, I didn't feel it going in. I didn't really feel it going out, and I don't feel anything from it. But I think I'm a very different case.
But also after my epidural, when I had to go to the OR, they treated me still with the epidural in because I had to be numb for everything they had to do. So I
had
like prolonged time on my back with the epidural in. So I don't know if some of it is because of that.
It could have been, yeah.
Because the way not to get too like graphic on you, but the way they stop a woman from bleeding like that in certain instances is they put their hand up into your uterus and massage the inside and the outside at the same time. And that's to try to get your uterus to contract to stop bleeding. Mm-hmm. So you need to be numb for that because that's essentially like a baby up in you. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Yeah.
What they eventually did want to get it to stop is they filled my body with a balloon to trick it into thinking it was pregnant in layman terms. Like,
wow.
After labor, I spent the next day with a balloon inside my body to stop the bleeding and a vaginal pack and all sorts of other miserable stuff. But
that must have been really uncomfortable.
It was awful. It was awful, awful, awful. And then, you know, because I lost so much blood, I had to give myself iron shots and all sorts of stuff following. But so that could be why my epidural area was so much more painful because I'm on my back more, whereas like in the delivery room, you're sitting up more. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But so in New York, without an epidural, it was 8,000 times more painful. Like,
okay.
I'm not going to lie. Like, it was insane. I thought each one of my limbs was being tied to different corners of the room. Hold, like, for real. But then when it was done, I felt like $1 million. And for baby number three, I'm absolutely going to try to go unmedicated again.
Again?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But it definitely was like, holy moly.
Yeah. But it's like interesting because that's how women gave birth for, you know, thousands of years. So it's
possible. We're capable. Yeah. You know, I just don't think any two births are alike. I don't think that.
Absolutely.
I don't know if my pain threshold is going to be the same next time. So like, I reserve the right to change my mind, but I want to go into it with the idea of being unmedicated and that kind of mantra of being able to tell myself I could do it again.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a very interesting experience. I left myself with an open mind when I went in. I said I was leaning towards the epidural, but I was like, you know, if I decide I don't want it, I'll just do that. But I ended up asking for it because I tapped out. Like, there was a moment, my labor, I had to be induced because I had gestational diabetes. So they induced me early, but it took longer than I thought it was going to take. Like, I thought they induce you and then like pop goes the baby.
No.
And that's not how it happened at all. Like, I was dilating so slowly. I think at hour like 36 or something like that, I had like a breakdown. I was like, why isn't it working? I'm such in so much pain. This is so awful. But they give you the Pitocin, right? And once the Pitocin kicked in, my water broke. And I think I had the laughing gas. Because I was like, and I didn't know that it, like, you're basically being drugged. I don't know if I would do that again.
I didn't feel that at all. It felt like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But honestly, I don't know, because you're in such a zone and under so much pain and distress. Like, I don't know what was real, what wasn't, what was what was my body, you know?
Yeah. I love that you had that experience of giving birth, and I'm glad that everything overseas, and I'm glad that everything went well. Like, that's definitely like an adventure, I guess you could say, right? Like, all the different things. And I imagine that the relief that you felt giving birth your second time and being able to be unmedicated and have things go a bit more smoothly.
And I try to use that story a lot, not to scare people, but just to tell people, like, if you do have any sort of trauma, it is possible to have a healthy, normal pregnancy. And anyone is like afraid of that. Like, the best thing I did for myself was have like a month of therapy before the delivery of my second. And the therapist like really just focused, because I had what was a form of PTSD from it and worrying
of course
it's going to happen again. And I would leave my daughter without a mother and, you know, all of that. So I think that really gets your head in the game and you focus on how you're a survivor and not a victim. Mm. And I think,
wow,
like anyone that's been through anything similar, anything scary, you know, or even like miscarriages, like, it always helps to talk to someone and just understand that the odds are actually more in your favor than against you.
That is sound advice. And I think something that I've been slow. Finding a therapist has been on my to-do list forever. And I don't know why I'm delaying it so much. It's almost like self-sabotaging behavior. Like, I'm afraid for it to actually work and be successful, or I don't know. But I feel like, especially if you have had a traumatic birth or, yeah, gone through some sort of trauma like that, it is so healthy to prepare yourself during pregnancy for game time.
Yeah, right? Another thing I like really recommend to people, following your birth after enough time, because you're really sensitive and fragile in the beginning. I recommend that everyone, like at their 6-week appointment or whatever, sits down with their provider and have them take you through the notes, because you may have questions about your birth, or things may not have sat right, or you may wonder why they give you this drug when, and you'll get so much satisfaction. You'll really be able to own your own plan of care and your future if you understand the reasons behind things like that. And I really recommend even non-traumatic births, just to really understand what went down, because you're going to make up stuff, you know, you're not going to remember that as well. And you're going to fill in blanks where you might have medical notes to help you do that a little more soundly.
That is fantastic, because I had a very bad allergic reaction after I had pups, which is like a rash around your belly button. And it starts usually, it's pretty rare, but it usually happens. It's like the stars have to align. You have to have gestational diabetes. You have to be giving birth to a boy. And something about the testosterone and the hormones and the diabetes just like triggers this allergic reaction. It starts off as hives. And most women, it goes away once you give birth and the placenta is out. But for me, my whole body erupted into 6 weeks of hives. And that, I guess looking back, I do have a little bit of trauma from that because I really feel like I wasn't able to enjoy my son. I was just in so much pain that it was awful. And I agree. I feel like if I was able at that 6 weeks appointment, if we sat down and we talked about my notes, maybe we could have figured out, was it the pups or was it that I was allergic to vancomycin?
Yeah, like which what was point did that happen? Could it have been affected? Yeah. Like just feeling more
absolutely
the facts.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I love that. And we do talk about having baby number two. And right now we're not ready because we feel like he's 8 months, not turning 9 months. And we just feel like we've come up for air. Totally. But one of the things that I think about, I'm like, oh, am I ready to go through that again? Like we want a bigger family, but I don't know if I can do it. And of course, it's all that like, it's that negative self-talk.
Yeah, like a lot of guilt. Like we hold a lot of guilt. Yeah. Like, did this happen because I could have done something differently? So I could be talking to a provider and understanding odds and risks and therapists. Like it just really gets your head in a good place because like childbirth is not an easy thing. Like it is a trauma, no matter if you don't have trauma, like your body is literally going through something like you're a wild animal. Like it's crazy. And I just have to say that this is like, I'm in Connecticut, but I'm in a pandemic too. So this is a different experience, but I get way more time with the provider than I've ever had because it's just hospital and they just sit down and talk to you. They'll sit with you for an hour. You get a private room without having to pay. So I'm seeing a lot of these like niceties that I didn't have before. Obviously, when someone has had, there's good doctors everywhere, of course. But when someone has, you know, a high risk situation, like, did I take comfort in being in New York City because there are so many doctors and the best in the world? Yes, but I do have faith in my team. And it's the hospital has good ratings and stuff like that.
That's awesome. Yeah. So let's shift gears a little bit. So you made a complete lifestyle change from living in New York City to moving to a more rural part in a historic home in Connecticut. What inspired you and your husband to make that big change?
My husband lost his job. He lost his job the first week of the pandemic. He was he was a COO of an events company, but more focused on like technology behind events. And obviously that industry just died. So he was let go and the whole company shut. Like, so there was not a company at all after that. There's still not, which is really sad because the founder is just such a great guy and like our heart breaks for everyone involved. So he was unemployed. We were living off of savings because, you know, New York City is so expensive that like the New York State unemployment is a state average. It's not a city average. Mm-hmm. So you're getting an average from rural New York, which doesn't account for the cost of living in New York City.
100%. Right.
So our lease was up in June. We have this house here in Connecticut where it's a rental property and our tenants were leaving. So in June, so it was perfect. So we're like, let's just move here. So it's kind of forced. I think the term historic home sounds a lot nicer than it is.
Oh, I don't know. You were old. I guess I live in an old home too, but it is historic. Like it's from 1890.
Yeah, this was built in 1900. So it is historic. It just feels more like just a project, a big project. Currently, we have a completely gutted kitchen, a completely gutted bathroom. My husband is working on it all himself. He got a new job back in November, which has totally slowed the construction project. So now it's just a race of construction versus baby, like which one's going to come first.
Oh my gosh.
We have a lot of land, which is nice. We'll only be in this home for another year or so because it's very small and we can't have three kids in here. So then we'll just rent it out again when it's fixed. But yeah, it's been a big shift for sure. For sure.
Yeah. So what do you miss most about city life?
The convenience, like just getting anything you want for food delivered. Like here, I mean, we're in like a really extremely rural part of Connecticut. So like, you know, we don't have stoplights. Like we don't have the towns share zip codes. Like my town where I'm from was smaller than my building in New York. Like that's perspective.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah,
so these towns have like, you know, 1,000 people, 1,500 people, like they're small. So, you know, the only thing that delivers is one pizza place a town over. Like you're not able to get every cuisine, you know, from these gourmet restaurants or whatever. So I miss that. And I just miss feeling like I'm around people, just being able to look out the window. Like I missed
that
sense of, but I feel so much safer here because before we were going through the elevator or the hallways and we couldn't not be around people. And here I feel like I can just hide away during COVID and not come into contact with anybody.
Yes. Yeah. Before we lived in Thailand, we lived in Boston. So we had a house like really close to the city, just like 10 minutes outside. And like I could reach out my window and hold hands with my neighbor. Like that's how close our houses were. And I get that. I get the convenience because definitely where I live now, same thing. No Grubhub, no Uber Eats, no Domino's doesn't even deliver. So really, actually, I'm very shocked. Amazon Whole Foods delivers.
Don't get that. And I'm so sad. I'm so sad. We don't have Amazon.
Oh my gosh.
We don't have a Trader Joe's like anywhere near us. It's like an hour.
Oh yeah, we don't. Oh wow. Our Trader Joe's is like 20 minutes away, which I guess isn't that far, but the pandemic has made me really lazy to drive anywhere.
So that's like, you know, a frustrating point. I did used to live in Newton, Massachusetts. So in that.
Yeah,
in Newton Center.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Newton's so cute. It's interesting because, so yeah, we went from Boston to Thailand, and in Thailand we lived in Bangkok, and I did like city life, but then I also grew really tired of it too, because I just felt like people were always in your, like, I just felt really suffocated. So what do you love most about about country life right now? Do you think you guys will continue to live where you're living, or?
So, you know, there is that feeling of home because we grew up here. Our families are here. Now, we don't see any of our family unless they come masks on in the backyard. So we do not see anybody, but they're not far. Like my dad will come by this weekend and like throw a snowball at my girls and bring a cinnamon roll or something like that. So there is that good feeling of being home. And it's just beautiful. Like our part of Connecticut is where like the show Gilmore Girls was based off of. So it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it definitely has that like really quaint, really cute Connecticut town vibe, which I love. But we will meet somewhere in the middle. I could never go back to the city again. The girls are thriving in the outdoors. Mm. That chapter is closed for us. But this is too rural. We'll meet somewhere in the middle, probably in Southern Connecticut, especially with my work, because he might have to have more access to the city and be closer. Because right now we're about 2.5 hours north of the city. 2 hours.
It's far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But he threatens all the time that we'll have to move to Singapore with this job. So
that's so cool.
It's not.
That would be.
I'm too old and tired to keep moving every 2 years.
I guess I understand that too, because when we lived, I'm just like, Singapore's so cool. Like it was the one place we didn't go, but we always heard it's amazing and super, super nice too.
It's very nice. It's very clean. It's very posh. Did you see Crazy Rich Asians?
Yes. Yeah.
We watched it last weekend and it's based in Singapore. So I'm like, are you playing this to like subconsciously like plead your case?
That's 100% what he was doing.
But
I mean, I get the feeling of being tired of traveling, because we were basically like digital nomads for 2 years, and we traveled a lot. And by the end of it, I was so, and it sounds so spoiled, right? I was like, I'm exhausted. We were in Nepal, and I remember being like, I'm so exhausted of traveling. Like, I don't want to travel anymore.
You didn't even have a kid yet. So imagine throwing kids in the mix and trying to stay on schedule and packing for them. Like, kids need so much packed for them.
Especially multiple, maybe, and it's a long flight to Asia as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I flew to Asia without kids, but never with. And I would need to do it like stopping 15 places to get there, because I don't have the energy for it. And, you know, when that was one of the main reasons that we moved back from London, because once I had my daughter, I just wanted to be closer to family. And in America, where like I wasn't traveling every vacation home back to America just to see people.
Mm-hmm. Like, exactly.
So I think we'll probably stay here. But
well, you never know. Never say never, right?
I've learned that. But now with baby number three, I'm like, I'm ready for a forever home. You know, we'll be moving next year or later this year, and I'm just kind of ready to have like a place where I could like bury the cats in the backyard and like,
and cultivate and like make it feel like your home, right? Like definitely having like a home base feels so settling that I totally get that feeling.
And I think it's good for the kids too to have that, you know. It's been so cool to give them all these experiences, but they're still so young, and I think to give them that kind of forever safe space will be nice.
Yeah.
And I don't want to invest anything in here, you know? I don't want to, like, do a giant vegetable garden because we'll just be leaving. And I want a place where it doesn't seem like it's all just short-term, you know?
Yep. I totally understand that feeling.
I'll tell.
So let's actually, speaking about vegetable garden, I was stalking your blog last night, and you have some really good recipes.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your blogging journey.
Oh, my goodness.
One of the things I love, I know you said in your, I think you said in your bio that you were inconsistent, but I don't know, just looking at your blog, it looks like you've been pretty consistent, and I commend you on that. That's hard.
Kind of what I mean by that is like, I don't have the desire to just stick with just food, or I mean, it's definitely become more consistent because I've taken a lot of travel out of it because we haven't left the house in a year, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I really just wanted it to be a place for me. And that's lifestyle, that's kids, that's, that's beauty, that's food, you know, that's everything. And I've really stuck with that. My food, like if you're talking like blogger world, like my food likes in comparison to the other pictures, like never get as many, but like, I won't give that up because that's what makes me happy. So like, I'm not going to kind of be a sellout and compromise that aspect of my life, you know?
You're not going to niche down. Like I know there's all this talk about you have to niche. If you want to be successful, you have to niche.
Exactly.
But I agree with that. I can't put myself in a little box. Like I'm multi-passionate. Like, I totally agree with you.
And I'd be doing it for different reasons than I am, you know? So I think that's the reason I just incorporate a lot of things. I started the blog because I was in London and, well, I started an Instagram because I was in London and I was just really isolated as a new mom, like away from most people I knew. And then I started the blog when I moved to New York City. Because I went to Disney World and I was like, oh my gosh, this place is crazy. And I had so many toddler tips from the situation that I started a blog just to blog about that travel aspect. And now it's kind of just snowballed into a little bit of everything. And it's been great. But you will find a little bit of everything.
I love that. But I think to me, I feel like that's what makes it fun to follow a blogger. Like I love seeing their whole life. And I still think that I know like the whole what's trendy is like niching and that's what does well. I'm using like air quotes. But like, for example, one of the bloggers that I really love is Pinch of Yum. She's a food blog. I don't know if you follow her.
No, I don't.
Her recipes are to die for. And she was like OG. Like she was like all, she blogged for like a long time. She like grew her business. Now she has like a course and a group, etc. But I wish she posted more. Every time she posted like something personal, I was like all over it because I was like, I want to know more about you. Like I want to connect with you beyond the food. So I feel like that's like something that I really like. So continue doing what you're doing because I think it's cool.
I think that it depends. I think if you're a mom, it's really easy to say okay to all the stuff on it. But I think that I have had followers follow my food, maybe male followers, that all of a sudden it becomes a little too much about like postpartum woes. Yeah. And it's like, why am I following this? You know what I mean?
I do usually block. I know this is going to sound really bad, but I usually do block most men from my page, like if they follow me, because, you know, pictures of kids.
If there's like, I mean, I won't like unfollow a man that it just seems like a normal dude. But if it's like a man that is private or has no pictures or a couple sketchy pictures, it does make me wonder what they're doing.
I know. And exactly. So I'm the same. Do you have any bloggers or celebrities that inspire your work or that you kind of turn to for inspiration?
I think it depends. Like I have people I love to follow for each category. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's a blogger called, and it's a man named Storebought Is Fine for food. And he basically does all of Ina Garten's recipes.
Cool.
And he's like super, super funny. And he's actually the only person that I like kept around when they like follow, unfollowed, trapped me.
Wait, what's that? Oh, they followed. Okay. And then once you followed them,
they follow you just to get you, and then they instantly unfollow you.
That's my pet peeve.
Mine too, but I like kept him on because I like his. So he trapped me like sinker. So that is my pet peeve. And then that's like for food. E. Bolognino, I don't know how to say her last name, is who I love for architecture and just getting inspired for the house. And then for like motherhood, I love Bethany Ciotola. Like, I just think she is so witty and funny about motherhood. So yeah, so those are like the different categories of people I really, really like to follow. But then also all my friends. Like, I think we sort of are a good community and just inspire each other all the time and really help support each other. So I really appreciate that side of things.
Yeah, I do too. Exactly. Like, I don't necessarily, it's just so interesting the shift. Like, I feel like celebrities were once the influencers, and then now I feel like I don't, like, how much can I really connect, as much as like I love Reese Witherspoon, for example, how much can I really connect with her life? Like, she just has a different access to things that I don't have. But bloggers that are like us, right? Like more motherhood everyday bloggers, I get so many ideas and inspiration and tips from.
Totally. I'm just not real. I actually don't think I follow any celebrities, like probably not. I mean, also when you're on it for a business, you're on it so much that it doesn't become as much, like I'm not sitting there perusing it just like for celebrity gossip or things like that. I'm doing it more as like just connecting to my friends. Mm-hmm. It feels like. I feel like sometimes like the celebrity stuff is just like a little bit of noise. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. My sister actually will send me things in my DMs like that she wants me to see. And I feel like that's how I see most things like about pop culture and stuff like that.
Yeah. Actually, okay, wait, while we're on this subject of pop culture. So I think in your bio, you mentioned that you're a Bachelor fan.
Yes, totally. For decades, like literally since the beginning. Like I remember Trista and Ryan's wedding when I was in high school.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I started watching The Bachelor, I think, early 20s, but I just fell in love with it because of the love stories. Like, I just honestly, I think I just love love, and I love any shows or anything about love. So that's why I fell in love with The Bachelor. But what do you think of this season? I know you mentioned you're a little bit behind, but have you sort of been following everything that's going on?
So I actually was talking to Kylie about this because she loves The Bachelor. So anyway, I've been watching it for decades. So I feel like I'm kind of old school Bachelor, mm-hmm. You know, because I'm like late 30s now. I don't know. So it's like was really prevalent in both.
You are OG.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this past couple years is the first time that I haven't liked the people. Like, I don't like Matt. And I think it's because he seems so young. And like previous years, it was always people that like you could see yourself dating. And now I feel like just kind of old watching it. Does that make sense?
Last season with Peter is when I really felt like, man, I'm like older.
Or Colton, like, come on.
You know what? I don't think I even watched Colton's season. Like, I missed the whole, like, Hannah B. I think I like, watched it a ton.
I feel like is more just mature. But some of the people are just so...
They're young.
So yeah. I think now the only thing I really like it for is the drama, which I... like, the crazy girls. Like, I have to say, like, that's entertaining. My friend's actually a producer of The Bachelor. She's really
that's so cool.
Yeah. I see her a lot on the screen. So I'm always like trying to tell certain people that we know. I'm like, oh, you need to be up there. But yeah, so that's the main reason that I'm not as hooked on it. Mm-hmm. I just think he seems kind of like a little boy. I'm not as invested.
There are a couple girls on there that are like 21, 22, 23. And also, you know what I think is interesting too? I feel like social media has, Instagram specifically, has really changed the Bachelor franchise, because I feel like now it's like a lot of people that want to get on it to become Instagram famous.
Yeah.
Or to become like influencers. Because I was even watching the Britney Spears documentary, Framing Britney. Have you seen that?
I watched it. It was really good.
We're halfway through it, but she just seemed so innocent and approachable, like in her early years. And I thought, man, I wonder, even my husband, who is like not a celebrity, he's like not into any like pop culture stuff. And he was like, we were watching it together, and he was like, you know, I just wonder if celebrities are different today. Like if being a celebrity in the 90s is just really different than being a celebrity now.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think it's good and bad though. Like, I think you could feel freer before, you know, which is great. But I think you're also more protected now. Like, I think Britney Spears, what they did to her would never have been able to take place in today's society. And there is more accountability, you know, talking about Chris Harrison and things like that.
Yep.
And, you know, I haven't watched, I don't know if they've addressed Chris Harrison in the show yet. I don't know if that episode has come up yet. But, you know, it really is about accountability. And like, the Bachelor franchise definitely has like a long way to go in terms of like being inclusive and things like that. But like, you know, your comments mean things. And when you're a public figure, it means things. So I think that's great for everyone that that's coming to light, you know?
I agree. Like, even the segment of like celebrities reading mean tweets, I feel like I feel like with Britney, what happened was, I feel like almost everybody dehumanized her. Like, she was reduced to something less than a dog, it felt like. And it was just heartbreaking. Like, I felt really, really sad.
I mean,
watching.
I put this in my story. It made me feel bad for me, because I was that little girl that, was her target age range. And it just made it made so much sense why, you know, me as a 14, 15 year old and my friends had the issues we had, either about our bodies.
Yes.
Or the men spoke to us a certain way. I mean, men, boys, like they were, you know, middle school kids and high school kids. But it just made sense because of what was allowed back then in society. Yep.
No, that is so, so true. Even what happened with Justin Timberlake, and I know he came out and apologized for a lot of that, but even when, you know, when they broke up, everybody blamed her. Mm-hmm. I had a flashback to my own youth. Like, I had a boyfriend and he was like kind of cool. He was like 16. I was 15, right? And he, one afternoon, I was going to go home and he wanted me to come back to his house. And I said no. And he put his hand on my neck and he held me up against the fence and he said, "You're coming home with me." And we broke up after that, right? Because I was like, "You put your hands on me, like that's not okay, like I'm breaking up with you." The next day he spread all these rumors about me, and he was like the golden guy, and I tried to tell people. It was like, "How dare Lena," and they used the words like "that slut," "that this," "that that," and I was a virgin. Like, I had, you know, it was just very, it was a very awful experience. I remember trying to tell people, even my friends, like, "He did this to me," and they're like, "JP, he wouldn't do that. He's such a good guy. He's so funny and nice all the time." And I was like, "You don't know who he really is." And I feel like in the 90s, like, that story wasn't unique by any means. I feel like,
I think exactly. That this day and age, there's been so much growth. And I just like hate when older people, like mothers, grandmothers, whatever, say like, "I would never have a kid in this day and age." Like, kids these days have it the best they've ever had it. They're going to be the safest. They're going to be the smartest. They're going to be the most in touch emotionally and with their bodies. Like, I have no qualms about raising two little girls and like soon to be a little boy in this day and age. By any means.
I'm so happy you said that, because I 100% agree. I've heard that before. Oh, these days. I'm like, are you kidding me? I would much rather have a daughter today than when I was growing 100%. Up. Like, before the Me Too movement, right? Like, we even forgot. Like, there was just so much, everything you said, spot on. And exactly, little boy, too.
And I think that's, you know, that's where the Bachelor franchise gets sticky. It's like, how much are we supporting, rooting for the crazy person and enjoying the crazy person? Because these are like real people. So it's just a sticky show. And, you know, if you think back, like, do you remember Temptation Island? Do you remember that show?
Yes.
that show had to end because someone had lied about having children, and they realized that, like, you know, that's a step too far, because you could really be ruining the lives of children by putting their parents in these situations. So I think that whole idea of reality TV, like, how complicit do these people want to go for, you know, this girl that, whatever her name is, Rachel, the one that went to the Old South party, that is.
Oh, right, right.
Like, how much does a reality show need to be involved in this level of what's swirling in social media? Because every contestant forever is going to be under this scrutiny with Instagram. So I think, like, the show is becoming way more than something that people can lightly enjoy, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Exactly. It's become less. Yeah, because it consumed me. I listened to, like, all the podcasts, about everything. Like, I really dove deep. And yeah, thinking about it, it has become more than just, like, a love story, like a show about a love story.
Remember, like, the rape question with Bachelor in Paradise?
No, I've actually never watched Bachelor in Paradise.
It's so, so good.
Everybody tells me
I think
that.
It's the best one, but it has a lot of that drama. And, like, maybe it was like 5 years ago. I don't remember the girl's name, but she ended up hooking up with someone on the first day when she was, like, blackout drunk. Like, she gave consent. Yeah. And she was, like, you know, totally fine with the situation. But a producer stopped and said, this is not okay. Like, she was taken advantage of, she was too drunk, blah, blah, blah. So then it became like a rape investigation, like a date rape lack of consent, ability to give consent. So that they stopped production for that. So they had that, you know, the girl had come forward even sober saying, I was still fine with it. Like, let me be, but they had that controversy. And now, you know, it's been a lot about their lack of inclusivity and Chris Harrison's comments. And I think that, you know, how can the show recover from, like, really thriving off of a lot of these people's, you know, ups and downs of their life and personalities.
Yeah. My husband actually did it because I was filling him in on all the drama, like a good wife, because he definitely really cared. Sarcasm, everybody. But he was saying, he's like, do you think this show is going to be around much longer? Because it seems to me like they're going into a lot of trouble. And I was like, I don't know. Like, that's interesting. Like, what does the future of Bachelor Nation look like?
So. I don't see it for forever, but you never know. My husband will let me put it on, and he has CNN and an AirPod on his phone. And that's how we watch it. But I have enough. Honestly, I'm so tired at night. You know, after the kids are in bed, like, we have like an hour and a half where we really watch TV. So, like, there's only so many shows. So we're finishing finally the last season of Homeland right now.
Oh, cool. That's a show that's been on our list to watch.
I think that's probably like my favorite show of all time. Seriously.
Really?
So, so smart and so incredible. Like, it is so good. It, like,
okay, we need a new show, so I'm going to talk. I know it's like a few years old now.
Yeah, so but the last season that just finished, it was season 8, I think it is. So I'm catching up on the last one. So it's going to be
That's sad. Awesome. I'm going to suggest that, because I've heard it's pretty good.
And if your husband's not into like the light and fluffy stuff, like, he'll love this, because this is all about, you know, war and Iraq and the Taliban and things like that. It's really, really
interesting. Yep, that is right up our alley. Well, Ashley, I feel like I could talk to you forever and ever, but I don't
know. I'm like, how did we get here?
I just love everything that I love your story, and I'm excited to see what's next for you.
Yeah, well, hopefully a completed kitchen and bathroom is before the right.
Yes, I'll be following closely on Instagram to see which wins. Thank you so much. So if anyone who's listening wants to connect with you about your experience, or just give you a follow on Instagram because you're awesome, where can they reach you?
So my blog is momuptown.com, and then @mom_uptown is my Instagram handle, because I was in Uptown Manhattan, but now I'm way uptown in Uptown Connecticut.
Mom up rural.
I don't know. So yeah, mom_uptown is where you can find me. And thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for listening, everyone. And I'll link everything in the show notes. Stay tuned next week for the next episode.
For joining us this week on the New Mamas Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, be sure to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite listening platform. Have a friend that would like this podcast? Share the love. Stay in touch. Definitely give us a follow on Instagram at New Mamas Podcast. I'd also love to continue the conversation with you on my personal account, so let's be friends. Slide into my DMs at Lena Forrestal. Finally, be sure to check out my blog at lenaforrestal.com for all things motherhood, homesteading, and recipes that both you and baby will love. Thanks again, and stay tuned for next week's episode.